You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just delivered his controversial speech to the US Congress.
Don't be fooled. The battle between Iran and ISIS doesn't turn Iran into a friend of America. Iran and ISIS are competing for the crown of militant Islam.
We'll be discussing the fallout also ahead. Russians bid farewell to murdered opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, but Polish and Latvian senior officials say they've been denied entry to Russia to attend the funeral. We'll ask what's next for Putin. We'll also look at US-Venezuelan relations as Venezuela imposes limits on the number of American diplomats based in Caracas. My guests are Kathleen Burke and James Schneider. They'll be giving us their views on the top stories of the day. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. First, though, let's take a look at some of the day's top headlines so far. As we just heard, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has just delivered his controversial speech to a joint meeting of Congress in Washington, D.C. He warned the United States against agreeing to a nuclear deal with Iran, saying Tehran will always be an enemy of America. Officials in Afghanistan have been accused of a slew of human rights abuses. That's according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. In Burma, police have blocked students demonstrating against a new education law that they claim curbs academic freedom. A Paris court has fined a journalist for broadcaster Al Jazeera €1,000 for flying a drone without authorisation over the French capital while the city was under a high security alert. And here in London, the Speaker of the House of Commons is warning that MPs and peers may be forced to relocate because the building is crumbling. We'll be discussing that in more detail on tonight's Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. A couple of headlines from the papers. LA Times on Skid Row, sweeping change adds to distrust. This is obviously following the shooting by an LAPD officer of a homeless man. And the Sydney Morning Herald, which will soon be arriving on doorsteps across Sydney in Australia. A journey to execution begins. Bali Nine ringleaders will be transferred to the execution island in Indonesia today. A big picture on the front of two of those men being taken off. Full story inside. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL here in London, and James Schneider, Editorial Director at New African Magazine. Kathleen and James, welcome to you both. Let's begin with Netanyahu. In his speech, he warned that Iran poses a threat to the entire world and the Iranian regime will always be an enemy of the US. His visit to Congress was organised without consulting the White House, which has provoked considerable irritation within the Obama administration. And of course, it's also had critics at home in Israel, given that the country is going to the polls in just 2 weeks' time. Before I speak to Kathleen and James, let's hear what President Obama had to say about the speech.
We think it's a mistake for the Prime Minister of any country to come to speak before Congress a few weeks before they're about to have an election. It makes it look like we are taking sides.
Kathleen Burke, that was President Barack Obama speaking yesterday. And having just watched that speech, it did look like a campaign rally for re-elect Netanyahu, didn't it?
Well, if that wasn't the reason he was there, I must confess I join the other four-fifths of the world who wonder what he thought he was doing. Obviously, he wants to mobilize Congress to try to stop Obama. But any law Congress passes saying you can't do this with Iran, he's promised to veto. What hold does Israel have over Obama as such? He's not going to be run for re-election again. He's alienated some of his most prominent and strong supporters in the Democratic Party by refusing to meet them separately. It's hard to know what he thinks he's doing. He has been accused by various columnists of having a Churchill complex, but as one ought to point out, if he wants to encourage the United States to go to war with Iran, to go to take military action, take out the complex, nuclear complexes, Churchill wasn't able to get the United States into the war until someone else bombed them. So if that's what he's trying to do.
It took a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has nothing to do with Churchill, if I may say so. So, I mean, James may disagree with me, but it seems to me that the only answer must be electoral, because he's undercutting a lot of his own support in the United States with no obvious good outcome.
James, do you agree, or do you think that actually there was a broader point here that wasn't just about hopefully shoring up support at home, but was perhaps about, you know, putting pressure on members of the House of Representatives in particular to say, look, we need your support here. The Obama administration is doing something which is, we feel, quite dangerous.
No, I'm afraid I entirely agree. Going so close before the elections, there's no real geostrategic point. Then Israel is not going to get a broader benefit from this. And in fact, I think it plays some additional risk to Israel and support for Israel in the US, as it does make it seem like a much more partisan issue than it has been for the last almost sort of 40 years, where Israel has been enormously supported by both political parties. And by, you know, making it really seem like this is the Republican-dominated Congress, which is trying to make Obama's life as difficult as possible anyway, on the ascendancy, and this is a part of the way it's making Obama's life difficult, basically making American domestic politics, which are quite sort of low and ugly at the moment, and transplanting those onto relations with Israel could backfire.
Well, one thing that we haven't mentioned, but which has some real reaction possibilities, is that he has entirely contravened the accepted worldwide protocol that the leader of one country does not go to talk in another country without at least the acquiescence, the obvious acquiescence. So the fact that Netanyahu not only didn't get Obama's permission, which he ought to have done, but he didn't even let him know it was happening. Now, this is something that some Republicans think was unforgivable as well. Mm. So in that sense, those Republicans that are beyond partisan but actually have an idea of the structure and how politics ought to be used and developed and conducted are also angry.
One imagines that if were Netanyahu to still be in office in a year's time and Hillary Clinton decides to pay a visit to Jerusalem and go to Knesset to make a speech and on her way says, oh, sorry, Bibi, I forgot to mention this to you, that he wouldn't be best pleased by that. James Schneider, reading some of the analysis or some of the views of commentators, let's call it views of commentators rather than analysis, you have some that will say the fact that Netanyahu is going to make this speech, despite the fact that Obama doesn't want him to, shows that Obama is weak.
No, it doesn't show that Obama is weak. He can't stop the Republican-controlled Congress from allowing, you know, whoever...
Oh, no, but the fact that Netanyahu feels that actually he can just go to Washington and make this speech, even though he knows that Obama doesn't want to do that.
Well, you could say that he's weak, or you could say that he's changed policy and his policy is no longer so firmly aligned with the right of Israeli politics. I'm not sure that's necessarily weakness. It does make it a bit more antagonistic to the mainstream of Israeli politics, but it's not, I mean, that doesn't make him weak, I don't think.
In fact, on the contrary, what it does is make Netanyahu weak. If he knew he had the strength to come to the US, he wouldn't slid in the side door like this.
Well, and actually, is there also an argument that given that, you know, and I think most people around the world will be touching wood and hoping that the Iran-US nuclear talks are a success, if that does happen, this doesn't put it doesn't particularly make Netanyahu look strong, does it, Kathy?
It makes him look like a bellowing, non-subtle, non-thinking, robotic reaction person. I mean, one sees why. I mean, he's concerned. He's desperately concerned about Israel. But the idea that what you do is to illegitimately try to force your main ally to come in and bomb, which can only cause a holocaust, and I use that word advisedly, in the Middle East, if it happens, one wonders what the man thinks he's doing.
I think the only person who's making Netanyahu's who can make Netanyahu look any better is Ayatollah Khamenei on the other side of this deal. He was basically trolling on Twitter Netanyahu's speech at the run-up to it yesterday. And, I mean, someone should take his BlackBerry away from him, because some of the things that that he was saying were extremely inflammatory and really didn't, you know, people who argue that a peaceful Iranian nuclear program, or one that is controlled and within international confines, isn't a threat to Israel. If you could read some of his tweets a particular way, it's difficult to make that argument. And so it might be only the diplomatic idiocy of a different world leader that can make Netanyahu's okay.
Kathleen Burke, can we get past, you know, the extremists, as some would say, on both sides on this? And I mean, when you look at, you know, when you try and read the tea leaves of an Iran nuclear deal, and, you know, I shouldn't have said Iran US deal, frankly, because the Europeans are in many ways leading this process and perhaps more involved than the US. Are you hopeful that this can actually happen, that we can get a solution sometime this year?
Sometime this year. Well, if we don't get some sort of solution sometime this year, everyone's red lines that have been drawn in the sand, saying we must do this, we must buy this date, will have been foregone, and who knows? I think there will be something will happen this year, or this something may be nothing happening this year, but there will be a termination, I think. There has to be. I mean, how long has it been going on?
Well, long enough, but that doesn't necessarily mean it has come to an end. Let's move on now. Thousands of people were today paying respects to the murdered opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, who was shot dead near the Kremlin on Friday. Not everyone who wanted to come to Moscow was able to make it, though, for the event. Senior officials from Poland and Latvia who hoped to attend the funeral were not granted entry to Russia. Alexei Navalny, Nemtsov's fellow opposition leader, also wasn't allowed to attend either, because he is under house arrest. James Schneider, does anything change after Nemtsov's murder, or do you fear that actually there is no hope, no chance of any sort of proper opposition in Russia?
Unfortunately, I don't think anything does change in a really fundamental sense, but that's because I think things were actually already quite so far gone. I think it will be an additional wake-up, if an additional wake-up was even required, to some international observers and commentators about the way in which the regime is going. But I don't think, if you're looking at the opposition, I mean, the opposition, the extra parliamentary opposition, was already completely defeated pretty much before this. People have been fled into exile. Navalny's under house arrest. I mean, that was already profoundly broken. I don't think that this was about trying to shut down the existing extra parliamentary opposition. I think it was a gesture to demonstrate a degree of power, to also show that the Russian population in general are going to be far less exercised about this. This is actually not an act that Putin is going to get in too much trouble for domestically, but will really scare and irritate the people that he wants to scare and irritate, who are some of the same countries that weren't allowed in for the funeral.
Kathleen Burke, some of the most interesting writing analysing this murder suggests that while it would be hard to pin this on the Kremlin itself, that certainly over the past year, the language that has been used by the Kremlin and allies of Putin to describe opposition people within Russia, referring to them as the fifth column, sometimes referring to them as traitors, has created a poisonous atmosphere that can actually get out of hand even for the people that have created it.
Indeed. I mean, what has happened with this murder for Putin, amongst other things, is deniability. I mean, it's who will rid me of this turbulent priest sort of stuff, in that what's happened is what he was really rather pleased would happen, I should have thought. But he's also happy that nothing can be pinned directly on him. I would be very surprised if it wasn't the security services. The sheer professionalism of it, the fact where it took place, the fact that, gosh, somehow the security lamp, the security camera ran out of film or whatever, it's hard to believe that it wasn't. I mean, it will scare. What it might do is drive some of the liberal opposition into more radical areas. Will they come together with some of the Chechen people? Who knows? There's going to be a limit to how much he can contain without actually really having soldiers on the street. The point of the liberal opposition is it's an escape valve. And if it's going to be obviously too frightened to act as an escape valve, that undermines an awful lot of what Putin can claim Russia is about. Maybe he doesn't care.
And James, in fact, are we most likely to see, if there is, a new opposition coming through, actually a more nationalist opposition in Russia that may eventually make some of us look back at the days of Putin and go, well, it wasn't that bad?
That's the game. Well, that's one of the games that the Kremlin have been trying to play with at least the sort of liberal arm of the Western establishment for the last 10 years. That's part of, they say, look, here's some nutters over here. They're even worse than Putin. Putin looks sensible in comparison. And that's what they've done to the domestic audience. They've had some sort of liberal elitist, sort of mini oligarchs like Nemtsov, who they can then show to the domestic audience and say, well, look, this is the other opposition. It's these liberal people who'll be even worse. But going back to the deniability, I don't think that Putin has done this to have any real deniability. I mean, how deniable can it be that one of the most watched men in the country, who is under permanent surveillance, is killed outside the government offices, exactly with the camera turned off and with a white van blocking the other image?
But I mean, there is enough deniability. In the sense that countries, whether that's the US, whether that's European Union or nations within the EU, can't then say, well, look, you've done this and we can prove it, so therefore we're going to impose sanctions or we're going to bar you from the G8 or anything like that. There is that degree of deniability.
There already are sanctions and there already is a barring from the G8, and there will not be a single government in the US or in Europe who doesn't think that either Putin has done it, or more worryingly, he didn't know about it and somebody else has done it and things are a bit more out of control. But those are the two options. There isn't a third, this might have been some other third force option.
Okay, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Kathleen Burke and James Schneider. When we return, we'll be looking at the deteriorating relations between the US and Venezuela. And I'll be telling you about a man from Namibia who I'm guessing you may not have heard of before. Stay tuned.
Every March, Monocle puts the spotlight on one nation, and this time, it's the turn of Japan. As the country looks forward to welcoming the world at the 2020 Olympic Games, we focus on the challenges facing modern Japan. Here's what our editors have reported on.
In the affairs section this month, we go inside the Japanese Foreign Ministry as they struggle to deal with an international crisis. In this month's business section, we take on the Japanese theme with a look at the country's stationery industry.
In the culture section, we take the temperature of Japanese media with a top 25 chart of the cream of the crop.
The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to find out how.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's no man's sight.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Kathleen Burke and James Schneider. Let's turn now to the steadily deteriorating relations between Venezuela and the United States. Earlier this year, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro accused the US of working with local opposition groups to organise a coup that would involve bombing the presidential palace. And just a few days ago, Maduro announced that his government had caught American spies. Now, Venezuela's foreign minister has given the US embassy in Caracas 2 weeks to cut down the number of diplomats from 100 to 17, which is also the number of Venezuelan diplomats based in the US. Kathleen Burke, now, it's very easy to look at Nicolas Maduro and what he's done to his country and go, well, this is just paranoia. What on earth is he playing at? But then his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, was the victim of a coup which the US at least had some knowledge of, wasn't he?
Yes, of course, there's a backstory to that as well, which is that Chavez tried to come to power in the first place by a coup when he was still an army officer and then decided to have Hugo again the more straightforward way. The U.S. and Venezuela have had rocky relations for a century or more. When it's a more conservative government, they work together with the U.S. When it's a less conservative government and when it's more and more radical government, the U.S. Gets very worried. It gets worried because of, in the olden days, it was worried because of communists. Nowadays, it's more likely to be worried of radicals that are going to undermine the United States' interests within Venezuela. But Maduro didn't need the United States to feel paranoid. He's got quite enough in his own streets to be paranoid about, I think. The man doesn't have, he has an approval rate, the latest polls, of 22%. So he's worried about any sort of support at home. So what do? You bring in the nearest North American boogeyman. 17, I like that. Mm. I would like to see who they decide to keep. Switchboard operator, of course, a couple of cryptographers.
I'm sure the visa department is still there. I'm sure, because I'm sure there'll be people within the government who still want to go to New York for shopping. James Schneider, you know, some people, you know, very few now still in Europe, but some people on the left in Europe have always looked at Venezuela over the past 10, 15 years and said, ah, look at what they're doing there, this wonderful socialist revolution. And less people say that now, don't they?
Yes, fewer people say that now because things aren't going very well in the economy, mainly because the oil price has fallen so dramatically and Venezuela.
Well, not just because the oil price has fallen dramatically. This is, you know, it's hard to look at that economy and say this has been well run.
Well, in the last couple of years, yes, I will agree with you. But I mean, if we're taking a slightly longer view and we're playing a bit of alternative economic history, and we take 1998 following the sort of economic policies which would be preferred by international institutions in the US, and then you look at the ones pursued by Chavez, and you look at the economic outcomes in terms of literacy, reduction of poverty, healthcare, so, you know, that sort of thing. Those outcomes are probably better than if the other policies had been followed. But there are upshots of that. The economy was not diversified really at all. So the economy just lived off rents, which meant it needed an ever-increasing oil price, and that wasn't dealt with. So that is mismanagement. But the country could still be in the same position now without some of those social gains that are genuine and were won over 15 years if those rents hadn't been distributed in the manner they had.
Kathy, but there is one interesting coda to the US-Venezuela relationship, which is, despite all this rhetoric, the US is still going to buy a lot of Venezuelan oil.
Yes, especially when it's so cheap. And and of course, they don't really need it, because at this point, the United States is an exporter of oil, not an importer. But that would be rather good for Venezuela, in fact. Yes, the problem with Venezuela here is that it bought a lot of support with cheap oil. And it's really cheap oil now, but they really can't afford to give it away anymore, because they were able to give it away when it had such a huge price that keeping half the money was really rather good. I mean, I very much agree with James. The economic mismanagement has been quite spectacularly impressive, if I may say so. The keeping a lid on prices, making it very difficult for companies to start, making it very difficult for companies to export any of their profits, so forth. Now, I mean, the point is the constraints on the economy, the idea that somehow if prices go up, it's because people are profiteering. It means that no one wants to do anything. No one wants to invest. No one wants to really create anything because they fear the government's going to take it over. And because more and more the mayors of various places and so forth are working against Maduro. He's losing control of a number of the regional areas. And that, too, I think is going to be extremely difficult.
And James, when we look at this, you know, situation in Venezuela, and we look at, you know, what Maduro is doing right now, it is hard to look at it, you know, whatever your political viewpoint is, and think, you know, this is a success. There are any sort of glimmers of hope here at all?
No, I don't think it is a success, and it doesn't look like he's managing the critique from a sort of left position of the Chavez regime was always that it wasn't creating any value that came from outside the state. It was all reliant on essentially creating a bureaucratic party type system through the state, which would then divvy up rents. And Maduro he's now in a consolidating position. He's not able to fundamentally reform that system. So no, there is actually very little to be hopeful about.
And then just very quickly, Kathleen Burke, often, you know, when we look at Latin America and the US, some people say, oh, well, you know, the US doesn't take any interest in Latin America. And then at times it's the US is taking too much interest in Latin America. Is there a middle ground, and have they found it in any country?
If the US is doing what a country wants, of course, they're going to like it. The U.S. really can't win in many respects. Sometimes it doesn't deserve to win, considering what they've managed to do over the past century and a half. If the U.S. ignores them because there are other things happening, they don't like that either.
Okay. Just finally, the Mo Ibrahim Award for African Leadership, one of the world's most valuable prizes, $5 million if you can win, has been suffering from a dearth of suitable candidates. It's supposed to go to a democratic president who has voluntarily stepped down in the past 3 years. But this week, for the first time since 2011, the prize was actually awarded. The winner is the outgoing Namibian president, Hifikepunye Pohamba. Pohamba is a former rebel who... See, I told you I get it, Kathy. Is a former rebel who fought for Namibian independence, and he served 2 terms as president and stepped down. James Schneider, this award has been going since 2007. Here's your starter for 10. There have been 3 winners.
4 now.
Three previous winners. Can you name them?
Yeah, Joaquim Chissano of Mozambique was the first.
Correct.
One. Then Faustus Mogae of Botswana was second.
Correct.
Then there were 2 years of no one. Then Pedro Pires of Cape Verde. I'd be surprised if anybody has heard of him. Then no one for a while. And now we have Pohamba.
Pohamba, indeed. James, what do you think it says about problems of democracy in Africa, that there have been so many years where they've looked around and gone, you know what, there's no one we can give this award to?
Yeah, I mean, on the surface, it doesn't look great. But I think the award is a sort of publicity loss leader for the main work that the organization does, which is their African governance index. So they're trying to get lots of data and work out which countries are doing well and which ones are doing less well. And in the years in which they haven't given out the award, they have made points about which countries are doing better, which ones are doing worse, and, you know, how and where. So yeah, it's not great that out of 54 countries there can't always be a good leader who's left recently, but that doesn't necessarily mean that African governance is failing.
Kathleen Burke, do you think the idea of the award has actually helped focus some attention on issues around democracy in Africa?
Well, to the extent that anyone notices it's happening, which is a difficulty. Yes, it can't but help to, I mean, one thing I particularly like about this recipient, he said he's going to use it for education. Mm. I mean, there's nothing more fundamental, unless there's health care, for the well-being of a country. And something that a man who sees this as a legacy, forgive me, must be a good man. And it's good for the country.
There we are. Hifikepunye Pohamba, remember that name. Kathleen Burke and James Schneider, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The programme was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Mike Hewin. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Tom Edwards will be with you for the next half hour with some choice tunes from Monocle's international playlist. And then, of course, at 1900 hours, it's our design programme, Section D. We'll be back same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.